the Isle of the Winds. Meanwhile, far to the west, a rather flustered King Aeolus found himself in the presence of an unexpected visitor. Dispensing with the pretense of a mortal disguise, such as had lately become the fashion amongst the gods when visiting humankind, Hera had flown to Aeolia in her favourite transport, a chariot of gold and silver drawn by peacocks. She stepped from it in full Olympian purple, attended by her 14 nymphs, 7 on each side. Walking backwards and bowing, Aeolus expressed his gratitude at so signal an honour, wondered if wine would be agreeable to her divine majesty, promised that the halls of his palace were to be her home for as long as she required, and quite, very proper. But you need not look so concerned. We have not come to empty your larders and cellars, you may have no fear. It is the service of your 4 servants that I require. The 4 servants to which she referred were Boreas, Notus, Eurus, and Zephyrus, the winds of the north, south, east, and west. Son of Hippotes, the mortal Aeolus had been entrusted by Zeus himself with the guardianship of these winds. In return, his home, the floating island of Aeolia, was a paradise of vines and fruit trees, and his large family a blessed and happy clan. No one is quite sure where Aeolia was, but the general consensus suggests a spot somewhere in the Tyrrhenian Sea, north of Sicily. So perhaps Ischia might be a likely candidate. Others favour the Lipari group, north of Sicily, also called the Aeolian Islands. Whether because they are windy or because that was his home is moot.
"What can the Queen of Heaven want with my winds?"
"There is a Trojan prince by the name of Aeneas." Hera did not enjoy having to speak plainly to the other gods, let alone to a mere mortal. But she swallowed her pride. Zeus's refusal to assist her with a storm directed at Aeneas had outraged her. She would, at first, have been satisfied with the ruination of the Trojan prince's plans, but now, in her fury, she could settle only for his complete destruction. She was motivated in this by more than her hatred of all things of and from Troy. That animus was powerful enough and would endure until the very last of that cursed race perished from the earth. But the death of Aeneas would ensure the future of her favourite human settlement, the city of Carthage. Carthage stood roughly where Tunisia now is. It was founded, like many cities along the North African coast, by the Semitic peoples of Tyre and Phoenicia, centred on present-day Lebanon, hence the names Tyrian and Phoenician or Punic used to describe the city and its people. The people of this North African city were dear to Hera's heart, as she was sure King Aeolus understood. She kept her chariot and shield there. The greatest temple in Africa was dedicated to her. Hera took her patronage over Carthage very seriously. One day she would see it rise above all other cities of the world as the grandest, richest, and most powerful empire of them all. Artemis had Ephesus, Athena her Athens, Zeus his Olympia, Aphrodite her Cyprus. Hera would outdo them all with her Carthage. The Punic Empire would rule the world, and her name would be glorified with it.
But what has this Prince Aeneas to do with the destiny of Carthage?
An oracle has foretold that the descendants of Aeneas the Trojan will one day destroy my city. This I cannot allow.
For reasons that need not concern you, my my brother Poseidon declines to send a storm against Aeneas' ship. So I now require you to release your winds, to spin it and smash it onto the rocks, and rid history of the possibility of Aeneas and his seed causing future disaster. The life of one man and his crew against the future of an entire civilization. I am sure you understand. Well, of course, but if Lord Poseidon is unwilling, I would find it difficult. We do not like to act out of step with one another, you understand? Hera missed nothing. Throughout their short conversation, she had noticed Aeolus's gaze flicking to the nymph closest to her left side. Deiopia, my child. Hera beckoned to the girl, who bowed her head and stepped forward. Aeolus gasped at the beauty of her face and figure. Hera put a hand to the girl's hot cheek. I have been trying to think of a household into which dear Deiopia might happily fit. Your own wife, I'm afraid I can't remember her name, is dead some 5 or 6 years since, I believe.
10 years, my lady.
10! How swiftly the years pass. Your children bring you pleasure, no doubt, but a great king should have a great queen, a companion, friend, and lover. How happy I am to have hit upon the thought of Deiopia as a fit consort for my friend, my obliging friend, Aeolus. Under black skies, a tempest of shattering violence tore into the fleets of Menelaus, Odysseus, Agamemnon, and Ajax. The moment it reached them, the sails, rigging, and booms of their vessels were blown apart. The masts and stays snapped and crashed, and canvas whipped and wrapped itself over everything, cracking, clapping, slapping, and smothering. The helpless ships pitched as high as temples before crashing down with a spank of keel on water that shivered every plank. The men inside bent to their oars and prayed. Menelaus's fleet lost 2 ships, all treasure gone, half the men swept away too. As to where they were, Poseidon had stirred his trident with such force that the sea around them eddied into a giant whirlpool. Whether the final fling of the tempest had cast them south, north, east, or west, Menelaus could not tell. The violence of the storm had thrown Helen into his arms, however, and for that he was grateful. His brother Agamemnon lost 1 supply ship, but was soon on course for Mycenae.
"Headed for home and happiness," sighed Agamemnon.
"Headed for blood and betrayal," cried Cassandra.
9 of Odysseus's Ithacan ships would need repairs, but no lives had been lost. The sails of all in rags, he commanded his men to their oars until land was sighted. It is more or less agreed that the class of vessel comprising Odysseus's fleet and those of most of the other Greeks was the Penteconter, a long, narrow ship with 25 oarsmen per side. When the wind allowed, they would sail, otherwise the grunt work at the oars had to be done. Odysseus began his journey home with his own flagship and 11 others, so a fair flotilla. It had given Athena no pleasure to see her favourite, Odysseus, so battered. But it enraged her that Ajax and his fleet had made it successfully to the lee of a rocky island where, sheltered from the howls of the tempest, he dared to stand astride his foredeck and laugh up at the sky.
Athena cried out to Poseidon, whom she knew had always favored Ajax.
Listen to this man. Listen to him.
Ajax was bellowing into the wind in crazed triumph.
I know it was you who sent this storm, Athena, but Poseidon, god of the sea, protects me and always will. No puffing, spitting squall of yours can harm Ajax.
The gods detest mortal presumption of any kind, but the presumption that dares to boast a special relationship between human and god is a blasphemy not to be endured. Poseidon thrust his trident towards the island. The storm that had been hurling itself against the windward shore now spun around the island and slammed into Ajax, smashing him against the rocks. So much for Ajax. Some suggest that the rock was Leuce, an island which has also hosted the shades of Achilles, Patroclus, and Ajax the Great. Leuce, off the coast of Ukraine, is now called Ostrif Smini, or Snake Island. Further out to sea, another tempest boiled. Aeolus, obedient to the wishes of Hera and anxious to win the prize of her beautiful Deiopia, had sent shrieking winds to toss and torment the 20 ships carrying Aeneas and his Trojans.